Good evening, everyone. Welcome. Good to see you all.
Good evening, John.
Good evening, Donna. Good to see so many of my Kadampa Center friends. Good. Wonderful.
Yeah. So, Don, we would like to start, if we may, with offering you a mandala.
Okay, sure. That would be fine, Donna.
So let me just get ready to go. All right.
Good.
Saji Puki Chukshing Meto Chomri Rovling Shi Nije Gyanpa Di Sangye Jindu Nikche Uwa Ijo Kunam Dag Shing La Chupar Shog Jetsun Lama Dampa Kenam Kichu Kukala Kense Chudin Trig Chitar Tampe Dulje Tinma Lazap Kechuki Charpa Wabtu So Iram Guru Ratna Mandala Kam Nirya Chayami.
Great. Thank you, Donna, for the chanting, and thank you, Laura, for offering the mandala, and thank you all for being here tonight. So let's go ahead and get started with just one other prayer for tonight. I'll put it up on the screen. Most of you know this prayer already, the Refuge in Bodhicitta. Let me scroll down. We'll just do that tonight. Refuge in Bodhicitta before the teaching. So we'll do this once in English and then twice in the Tibetan, bringing to mind these two thoughts. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha in order to benefit all sentient beings. Sangye Chodang Soki Choknam La Jang Chu Bardu Dakni Kyabsu Chi Daki Chanyan Gipe Sanam Gi Dola Penchir Sangye Rupar Shok Sangye Chodang Soki Choknam La Jang Chu Bardu Dakni Kyabsu Chi Daki Chanyan Gipe Sanam Gi Dola Penchir Sangye Rupar Shok. Okay, great. Let's go ahead and do a short meditation as well before we get started. So we'll do the first few minutes of focused meditation on the breath, and I'm sure each of you has a way that you already work with the breath, but if you need a suggestion, I generally encourage people to work with the area around the nostrils where you feel the sensation of the air coming in, going out as you inhale, as you exhale. And just making that your focal point, try to stay present with the breath, with that sensation, as best as you can. And any meditation we're doing with the breath, we want to have this introspection, sort of vigilance, checking in occasionally to see the quality of our meditation. And if we check in and we see that the mind has wandered away, then we just simply let go of whatever it was that distracted us and gently guide the mind back to the breath. So we're going to do a few minutes in silence on the breath in this way. I'll ring the bell to start that, and I'll come in a few minutes, and we'll just do a short reflection on compassion and bodhicitta so we set the best motivation for our time together tonight. Now let's set our motivation together. And as I mentioned a few minutes ago, we're going to look at compassion in this course. So I thought we'd start with meditating a little bit on compassion. Every one of us have the seeds of compassion within us. I'd like you to take a few minutes just to examine the ways in which you are compassionate. The beings that you care for, whether they be friends, family, maybe even pets, those beings whose suffering moves you and who you find it quite easy to tend to care for. And really just think about all the ways that you are compassionate right now that are evidence of the seeds of compassion within you. So just spend a few minutes thinking about those and also generating a joyous mind and reflecting upon all the ways that you already practice compassion. And then reflect on the idea of expanding this compassion to include not just those that you find it quite easy to be concerned about, but to the vast number of strangers, people in this world, beings in this world, and even in other worlds, if you have conviction in that, who we don't know, but nonetheless are suffering just like our dear friends, the loved ones that we already have that compassionate concern for. And even if we can challenge ourselves to expand that compassion to include the difficult people, those in this life, this world, who we find objectionable for us, whose views or actions we are opposed to, even their personality sometimes we're opposed to, those who have harmed us or those that we love or those we're concerned about, try to see that they too are suffering beings and worthy objects of our compassion. And ideally, we need to expand our compassionate motivation to include every single sentient being, regardless of whether they're a friend, a stranger, a difficult person. So just spend a minute feeling this movement of compassion out to include and encompass all beings. And then to unite this compassion that we have for all beings that we've generated with the wisdom thought, which is, again, the main topic of this course, is how do we bring these two minds together? And we can bring them together even right now at the beginning of this course by having the understanding that we ourselves can develop into the state of Buddhahood. Our minds are fundamentally pure. All the things that are obscuring our own minds are only there adventitiously, only there because we haven't created the causes to remove them. But they can be removed without a doubt. And moreover, all the positive qualities, compassion and so on, can be developed to a limitless degree. Within the understanding of what we call our Buddha nature, our ability to transform our minds into that state, we can generate the wish to do that, to become a Buddha, but we do it with the intention of being able to help all beings to attain that same state, which they can achieve because they too have Buddha nature. What obscures their minds is not there permanently, eternally. Rather, it is there once more adventitiously, only because they haven't developed their minds to the degree where they can remove those obstructions. So we generate the motivation of bodhicitta that is rooted in our compassion, but has the wisdom, the understanding, that this is a completely achievable goal, achieving our own enlightenment and helping others to do the same. Why? Because we all have that potential, that Buddha nature that can develop to that degree. So hold bodhicitta in your heart right now within that understanding, the compassionate wish to benefit all beings, and the recognition that if you do achieve your own enlightenment, which is, again, completely attainable, you then can help them to the greatest degree. And it's for this reason that we're gathered here tonight. And it's so good to see all of you tonight and be back with my friends in Raleigh. I wish I was there physically. It'll happen at some time, I imagine. But I do want to talk a little bit about the format for these classes. Since we have 2 hours, each of these 4 Thursdays, I will have a break about midway through, so about an hour from now, maybe a little less. We'll take a short break, about a 10-minute break, give you a chance to stretch, get some refreshment, use the restroom, whatever it is that you need. So that way we'll all be able to hang in there for the full 2 hours. The other thing I want to mention is I generally try to do these evening talks as a lecture for most of it and then do questions at the end. But if you find that questions are coming up for you and you don't want to forget them, you're certainly welcome to write them down, but you can put them in the chat box and they'll hang out in the chat box until the time when I'm ready to take a look at those a little bit later in the evening. But I generally try to allow for at least 10 to 15 minutes of addressing questions at the end. So know that that's a convenient way for you to work with our technology to put the questions out there, and I'll be happy to address them at the end. Not that I can answer every question, but I'll do my best. So, all right, so again, this course, we're calling it Uniting Wisdom and Compassion. I have to admit, this is actually a course that it was the very first time that I did a teaching at a center I was invited to attend in San Francisco, my old center, Seitan Ling, back in 2003, maybe, is when I did it there. I can't remember, 2002. I had taught a few times here in New Mexico when I came back during my breaks from the master's program. But while I was in the master's program and studying the text that we're going to be working with, a few verses from that as well as some commentary on those verses, when I was studying over there, I'd come back to New Mexico and do a few teachings here. But I had happened to make a trip to San Francisco, and the SPC there at that time invited me to do a course and said, "Do you have any ideas?" And this is the second text that we studied in the master's program, and the very first verses of it are really inspiring, really wonderful, and that's part of why I'm doing this course, is to share all of these those verses with you, and maybe they'll be as inspiring for you. But I did that course that time, and I actually just did it for Seitan Ling earlier this year, so it's also something I've done in a retreat format. It seems to work really well when you have some time to meditate on these topics. I will try to incorporate meditation if I can, but it's really hard with the amount of material I want to cover and just the 4 sessions. But I do have a meditation I've prepared, put together on the basis of Jeffrey Hopkins' book that he wrote, which I'll talk about a little bit later. Some of the topics at the very end of this course that are the main ones to meditate on, where we really bring together the wisdom teachings of the Buddha with the thoughts of compassion. So I'd like to start off with, I've got a little bit of a slideshow for tonight. Generally, what we're going to be working with is the text. So I won't be doing too much of a slideshow, and I hope these colors are okay. I realize it's really kind of bright blue, baby blue or something. whoops, where did that go? Ah, there. I somehow put it in front of the outline. My objectives for this course. First, to develop a strong regard for the importance of compassion as the root of the Buddhist path. I think we all know this to some degree, because perhaps that was even what drew us into Buddhism, was this orientation towards universal compassion. Certainly His Holiness the Dalai Lama embodies that type of ideal, and we can become very inspired seeing the way that he goes about enacting that in our world. But nonetheless, compassion at the beginning of these verses we're going to see is identified by Chandrakirti as the root of everything good that comes about in this world, all of the great results of the various practitioners and what have you on the Buddhist path. So that's the first thing, is to really give a bit of an emphasis on the necessity for compassion in our path and the role that it plays in terms of producing all the various results. The second one is to learn how to deepen compassion by informing it with the wisdom teachings of the Buddha. Of course, this is the main gist of this. As I just said, towards the end of this course is where we get into more of the wisdom teachings that we try to unite with our compassion. At the end of this course, we'll be talking about what are called the three types of compassion. And so that's where we will look at that more specifically. But even the teachings before that, I hope, also inform you to a large degree of the necessity of sort of bringing both wings of the bird, as we often say, into the path. I'll talk about this right now. Many of you know this teaching. Venerable Rabina uses it very frequently. But we can say that the path to enlightenment, getting to our destination, just like a bird needs two wings to fly, we need two aspects of the path. One is the compassion. The compassion is absolutely essential because it's the driving force that causes us to want to move in that direction towards benefiting all beings. And that's, again, one of the main things we'll be talking about during this course. But uniting it with wisdom, having that other wing, is what will actually allow you to get there. Having a compassionate wish to benefit all beings is fine and dandy, but if you don't have the means to accomplish that, to develop deeper insight yourself and to unite that with your compassion, then you're never going to get to the destination of full enlightenment. So this is the idea behind these, and, you know, to have both of these sort of, you know, flying together, to have them complementing each other. And of course, in the sutra path, which is what we're going to be looking at in this course, we won't talk so much about tantra. We see that these two do play a role of supporting and enhancing each other. The wisdom and compassion definitely are an integrated type of idea. In tantra, of course, you try to bring them into a single moment of mind. I'm not going to talk again so much about tantra, but tantra does take an approach where you even unite these further, where you kind of within the space of wisdom generate yourself in the form of a compassionate Buddha that wants to benefit all beings and so on. So there's a real profound way that wisdom and compassion are united in that path. But these teachings that are part of the sutra tradition, the more common, what they call the exoteric tradition rather than the esoteric tradition of tantra, these are the foundation for all of those teachings in tantra. So that's, again, I think an obvious point for this course. It's what the title of the course says, is uniting wisdom and compassion. So certainly this is the second objective, I think, is one that we'll definitely be touching on. The third one is kind of an important part of the study that we're going to do over these four Thursdays as well. It's to introduce Chandrakirti's text to you if you have not yet encountered it, that these verses come from. The text itself is in verse form. I don't know how many verses it is. It's quite a few verses. We're looking at just a few verses at the very beginning of the text that are the homage to compassion. But nonetheless, I want to introduce you a bit to the entire text, as well as Lama Tsongkhapa's commentary on it, especially for those of you who are new to this, and maybe even as part of this, because we're going to do this working with a commentary, introduce you to the whole idea of commentary, text-based approaches to studying the Dharma. Some of you have sampled the basic program of the FPMT, where that's the main approach, is to use a published text, a translated text that comes from the Tibetan tradition generally, sometimes based on an Indian text, such as Shanti Deva's text, for example, but essentially using a commentary on it as a way of elucidating the words that are in oftentimes verse form. And besides the verses themselves, there's also, of course, commentary, and I'm just pulling this off of my little pile of books here. This is a newly published version of Tsongkhapa's entire commentary. Now, it's a little bit hard. It's very thick, as you can see, a lot of pages, and it's very hard to just sit down and read this in its entirety on your own. We spent in the master's program an entire year, a year and a half on this text, and of course, Chandrakirti's verses that this is a commentary on. And it really does help to have someone who can kind of guide you through verse by verse and help to explain even some of the commentary, which can be a little bit difficult at times. But I'm not using this because, of course, it was just published, and also the master's program had permission to use an earlier version of the beginning commentary, which comes from this book that's been out of print for many years called Compassion in Tibetan Buddhism. Jeffrey Hopkins translated the very beginning of Tsongkhapa's text. So we're going to be using this in the translation that I provided to you that is, again, used in the master's program, or it was when I studied this text back in 2000, I think, was when I was studying this. So this is a little bit of a background, again, is to help you to appreciate all of what I'm trying to accomplish over four Thursdays, is to give you a little bit of the taste of that type of study, as well as, of course, you know, work on bringing the wisdom and compassion teachings together, as well as showing the centrality of compassion in our tradition. So what I'd like to do tonight, then, to get things started, I'll go ahead and put this back on the screen here, but again, I inserted that slide in the wrong place. So what I have to do is go back here to that. What I wanted to cover tonight, this is also on an outline that I believe you've been provided. These are the topics that I want to go into tonight, and if we finish these, we'll start with the actual commentary. But the first thing is to talk about the Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, and his teachings that have come to be known as sort of the Hinayana and the Mahayana traditions. And then we'll go into the four schools' tenet systems that were developed on the basis of those teachings. And that's just really brief to give you some of the terminology and a background on that. A little bit about what are called the three vehicles, and then we'll get into some people, some folks that are very central in terms of these teachings that we're going to be looking at. And then a little bit more about Chandrakirti's text, and then a little bit about compassion tonight. So let's go ahead and introduce the Buddha here. Most of you know Shakyamuni Buddha. His dates are debated, you know, as to when he actually lived. Some say 6th to 5th century before the Common Era. 5th to 4th is certainly accepted in some circles. He essentially attained enlightenment at the age of 35 and taught for another 45 years. And, of course, all of the teachings he gave were put down into written scriptures, the sutras and so on, in the years after his passing away. What we are mostly focused on in terms of this type of study, and what Chandrakirti's text is mostly focused on, is what's mentioned here, the Prajna Paramita Sutras, the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. This is what essentially Chandrakirti's text is working on elaborating on, but I'm going to go into all the little key figures that, you know, kind of fit into all of that. So Shakyamuni Buddha himself, of course, he taught for many, many years. I mean, 45 years is a long time, you know, compared to some spiritual figures we have in human history who aren't around very long and don't teach so much, and their actual spoken words are very few. But the Buddha taught for so long that he ended up giving many different types of teachings to many people that had different dispositions. Some people from the outside of Buddhism looking at this might think, well, the Buddha wasn't a very good teacher because he didn't teach consistently. To some people he would say one thing, to other people he would say another thing. But in Buddhist tradition, we say that this is like a good doctor. A good doctor doesn't prescribe the same medicine to every patient that comes in the door, right? You'd end up giving stuff to people that they're not ready for, that's too much for their system, or that isn't even addressing their problems, and you'd end up, you know, having a really sort of haphazard way of approaching medical care. Well, in terms of mental care and what the Buddha is doing for his disciples at the time that he lived, when there were people there that wanted particular teachings and needed particular teachings, he taught to their karma, to exactly what they needed. So in retrospect, these teachings things can be looked at and divided essentially into two main camps. And this is what, again, we call the Hinayana and the Mahayana. So what I'm going to do now is put on the screen the first of these handouts. Again, I think this is also something that you've been supplied that is available to you. In this first handout is where I'm going into a lot of the background that I'll go into tonight. And by the way, because there are four handouts and we have four classes, it doesn't necessarily mean that there's a complete overlap with regard to those, you know, that next week we'll do the second handout and then the third week the third one and the fourth week the fourth one. It'll be around that, but, you know, it will vary to some degree. So when we talk about looking back on the Buddha's teachings, they essentially divided them into two major tenet systems. Tenet is essentially a philosophical position or view. And so there are two main views. One is the Hinayana tenets, which is, this is the more traditional word in Sanskrit that's used. I've heard this translated more recently as the fundamental tenets, or, you know, using that kind of idea. It's the initial teachings of the Buddha that were written down that have become the Pali Canon. Many of you know of the Pali Canon, the teachings that are used in a lot of the traditions in Southeast Asia. Then we have what are called the Mahayana tenets on the right-hand side there. Mahayana is sometimes translated as the universal vehicle or the universal tenets, you know, the idea being that we have a greater focus on moving to that goal of Buddhahood, as opposed to in the Hinayana tenets, there tends to be more of a focus on developing one's own liberation, achieving liberation from samsara. You know, and the Buddha taught, again, both of these as completely valid systems, and within each of them there are two individual systems, which I'm, again, not going to talk about quite that much. I'm just introducing you to this concept. In the basic program, there's an entire course on these tenet systems where you go in and on the basis of seven different key topics, you investigate each of these systems. There's what's, in terms of the Hinayana tenets, there's what's called Vaibhashika, usually translated as the Great Exposition School or System. Then we have Suttrantika, which is the Sutra School. Again, both of these, they're called Hinayana tenets because they do, I guess I said, emphasize primarily the path to one's own liberation. But moreover, they also don't do as deep of an investigation into the nature of reality. Again, these are some of the wisdom teachings we'll be touching on as part of this course. But essentially, they say there is a problem that we do have around ourselves, the I, the person. But when it comes to other phenomena, there's not so much of a misperception going on. And so in that way, they have a very limited view of the wisdom teachings of the Buddha to a great degree. So those are the main things that kind of distinguish them from the Mahayana tenets. In the Mahayana tenets, again, on the right-hand side there, we have the third and the fourth of these four tenet systems. Chittamatra, which is usually translated as mind only, and the Madhyamika, the middle way. We in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition are generally propounding the middle way, and not just the middle way in a general way, but also within the two sub-schools of the middle way. The main one that we are focused on is the item B there, 4B, Prasangika Madhyamika, which is the consequence middle way school. But Svatantrika Madhyamika is a stepping stone to get to the consequence middle way. The autonomy middle way, as you're going to see, was another system that was based on some of the same teachings as Prasangika Madhyamika, but a slightly different interpretation. So essentially, these schools that are considered Mahayana tenets, they do look at the nature of things beyond the person, beyond the I that we are having these misconceptions towards. They also investigate phenomena at large, meaning, you know, apples and computers and you know, chairs and bodies and whatever, all the various phenomena that are not persons. And they find that there is an ignorance operative with regard to those as well. Again, this is something we'll get into a little bit later in this course. So that's the main thing that distinguishes them from the Hinayana tenets. They do also have a tendency to emphasize the bodhisattva path, the universal vehicle, the way in which we can achieve complete enlightenment. But they, of course, also propound a path that will lead to individual liberation. So that's where we kind of, that's about all I want to say about the tenet systems at this point, but we can see that, again, there's another way of talking about Hinayana and Mahayana, and that's in terms of the paths which are set out under that next item, item B, the three vehicles, as they're often called. The word yana is often translated as vehicle, and in this context, Hinayana means sort of an individual vehicle, a way that we achieve an individual liberation, our own solitary liberation from samsara, which of course again is the very first teaching the Buddha gave on the Four Noble Truths and how each of us are caught up in suffering, dissatisfaction. The causes are within our own minds. We can have freedom from that if we practice the path. And so right from the beginning, the Buddha taught Hinayana paths. He taught paths of attaining individual liberation. The result when one practices a path that leads to your own liberation is usually called foe destroyer. The Sanskrit for it is arhat, A-R-H-A-T, or sometimes arhan, I think is another way I've seen it spelled. But essentially, it means someone who has abandoned what is keeping them caught up in their own cycle of existence, their own suffering and dissatisfaction. We're going to get into these more when we get into the text. There are two different types of practitioners within the Hinayana paths. One are called hearers, or shravaka in the Sanskrit, and the other are solitary realizers, or pratyeka Buddhas. They're not Buddhas in the way that we use the term Buddha, but there is going to be a commentary on that as well. They do have a realization that leads them to get this title. But anyway, they are solitary realizers of the truth. And so in that way, these two different practitioners are two different ways that the Buddha set out an opportunity for two different types of people, two different dispositions, to practice a path that leads to their own liberation. On the other side, where we look at underneath the Mahayana tenets, we have the Mahayana path, which again, it is emphasized a lot in the Mahayana tenets. That is, of course, the Bodhisattva path. That's the third vehicle after the hearers and solitary realizers. The result of that path, of course, is Buddhahood. As we were generating the motivation for tonight's class, this is what we're doing, is generating the motivation of bodhicitta, which is what signifies someone as being a bodhisattva. Bodhi being the root word that Buddha is derived from, which means awakened, enlightened. And of course, this is the goal of someone who is on the Mahayana path, is to attain universal concern for all beings, to practice the universal vehicle that will lead to that result of being able to benefit all beings. So essentially, when we talk about all the Buddha's teachings, we can talk about them in two different ways, and the systems, the philosophical tenets that we can parse up into these four different schools, and even that, again, there are more sub-schools beyond the two that I have there for the middle way, but know that those I'm just emphasizing because of the presentation that I'm doing as part of tonight. But essentially, there are ways of looking at the Buddha's teachings from that perspective. What are more Hinayana tenets versus Mahayana tenets? Then there are also, of course, the individual topics that one practices and develops in one's own mind that either lead one on a Hinayana path towards attainment of one's own liberation in the state of a foe destroyer, or the Mahayana path where you end up achieving a more universal goal of Buddhahood for the benefit of all beings. So that's, again, just a little preparatory thing, because some of these are going to come up as we look at some of these individuals who are involved in the context, the historical context for these teachings we're going to look at, which even though they're, you know, centuries ago, have complete relevance to our time today. Okay, so if we consider when the Buddha achieved nirvana, which again was when he was 80 years old, when he passed into nirvana, if we start with that as the beginning point, and then everything else is after nirvana, we see that again, while the Buddha was alive, before he passed away, he taught both the Hinayana, the individual vehicle, and the Mahayana, the universal vehicle. He expounded, as I mentioned with that slide, particularly on what are known as the Prajnaparamita Sutras, the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras that speak to the ultimate form of wisdom that we need to generate, that is generated in the mind of a bodhisattva together with this compassionate motivation. And then it says, after Buddha's nirvana, the Hinayana proliferated while the Mahayana declined. There's a lot of mythology around what happened to the Mahayana. Many of you have heard some of these stories where essentially they say that a lot of the sutras that were in the Sanskrit tradition, the Sanskrit canon that are the Mahayana sutras, they disappeared to various worlds. Some of them ended up in the land of the Nagas, these sort of snake-like beings. And whether you believe in all these things or not, essentially the teachings did sort of disappear from this world to some degree. And the more common teachings of the Buddha that were proliferated throughout Asia were the Pali Canon, the Hinayana corpus of teachings. So those were what really took root, and people began, of course, practicing those teachings that led to their own individual liberation. Now, again, those tenet systems also do, of course, teach that you can become a Buddha, because they have to, because there was a Buddha. Buddha Shakyamuni achieved that state. But they essentially say that it's not that common for people to want to attain Buddhahood. On the Mahayana side, they say, of course, we all have Buddha nature. We all have the potential to achieve that. And when the Sanskrit sutras came along and were more widespread in the world, then, of course, all of the techniques and the practices that lead to attaining that state became more well-known and more common. And this, of course, is why we have the Zen tradition, the Chan tradition in China, and so on. So many of the Northern Asia traditions that came out of that whole movement of the Mahayana scriptures. But essentially, when the Buddha passed away, again, the teachings that were first codified, first put down, were the Pali Canon. And what happened to the Sanskrit canon, again, is a little bit of a mythology around it, but these things were not widely available in this world until Nagarjuna came along. So let's go to Nagarjuna, who is now the next person on this little chart here. Again, about 400 years after the nirvana of the Buddha to 1,000 years. Now, again, why does it have a 600-year span? Well, some people actually hold that Nagarjuna lived that long, that he actually lived for hundreds and hundreds of years. But his dates are very unclear. Obviously, when you start dealing with history that far back, it's difficult to pinpoint things. But Nagarjuna is said to be the founder of the Middle Way School. Remember, that's the second of the Mahayana schools. And, of course, he essentially went to the land of the Nagas, or wherever these Prajnaparamita sutras were kept, and brought them back into this world. But he was prophesied, as it says there, by the Buddha, as one who would reinstate the Mahayana teachings, because, again, they had declined to a great degree before he brought back these Sanskrit sutras. Some of those Sanskrit sutras were also used to develop the mind-only school, but the entire corpus of the Sanskrit scriptures, sutras, is something that, again, appeared a number of centuries after the Buddha had passed away. Now, what he's known for is he wrote a text that's called Fundamental Treatise on the Middle Way, called Wisdom, the Prajnanama Mula Madhyamaka Karika, which is based on the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. Let me share a little slide that has a picture of Nagarjuna, so you have a little painting of Nagarjuna, so you get some idea of who he was. Again, his dates are a little unclear. In the, you know, like Wikipedia sorts of things, they say about 100 years he lived, from around 150 in the Common Era to 250 of the Common Era. But again, dates are really sketchy around Nagarjuna. And again, there's the text that he wrote. Now, this text that he wrote, again, it was based on the Prajnaparamita Sutras. If you've ever gone back and read any of those, of course, we read the Heart Sutra regularly in our tradition. That's one of the Prajnaparamita Sutras, but a very short one. There is also a one in 100,000 stanzas, one in 25,000 stanzas, another one in 8,000 stanzas. And if you go back and try to read those, they're very terse, very hard to get the meaning of. Well, Nagarjuna felt that it was important to expound upon the Prajnaparamita Sutras, and in 27 chapters of his text, which we usually called Fundamental Wisdom, that text elaborated upon these teachings that are the wisdom teachings of the Buddha on emptiness and the final point of view of the Buddha in terms of how to look at the nature of reality. So he himself composed versified texts, and of course did some other commentaries as well, but essentially that the entire 27 chapters of that text that I just mentioned, Fundamental Wisdom, is in verse form. Well, that required, of course, people to provide commentary on those verses. And one of the people that did provide commentary was Chandrakirti, the author of the text that we're going to be looking at. But before he came around to do that, there were other commentators who kind of entered into the picture. So here's why I have to go back once more to our little handout, the first of these four handouts, and talk about what happened between Nagarjuna and Chandrakirti. This time frame that's from around 900 after Nirvana to 1050 after Nirvana. First of all, there was someone named Asanga, who you may have heard of. Asanga became the founder of the mind-only school. Again, the sutras that were brought back by Nagarjuna contained a variety of teachings, and one of them supported an idea that the mind-only school took off with and ran with. And I'm not going to get so much into their point of view, but it's a very different point of view from the Middle Way school. But of course, his teaching started showing up, and people started thinking, oh, this is the correct wisdom. This is the correct view of things. In the meantime, Buddhapalita, the next bullet point there, wrote a commentary on Nagarjuna's text, Fundamental Wisdom. And he elaborated on what Nagarjuna said to the point where he actually described very clearly what has come to be known now, again, as the Prasangika Madhyamaka, the Middle Way Consequence School. And this is the final point of view that we hold in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. But nonetheless, there were people who took issue with what Buddhapalita wrote. There was this practitioner named Bhavaviveka. I think his commentary was called Blaze of Reasoning or something like that. I'm not sure about Buddhapalita's. Buddhapalita's, by the way, is coming out in an English translation later this year, which I'm really kind of excited about, because Tsongkhapa himself was told by Manjushri to study Buddhapalita's commentary to discern the correct view of emptiness. But nonetheless, Buddhapalita's text became a little more obsolete because after Bhavaviveka came and started propounding upon the fundamental wisdom from a different angle and said Buddhapalita's got it all wrong, he refuted both Asanga and Buddhapalita and became the founder of that other school of the Middle Way, the Middle Way Autonomy School. So again, to go back up to our little chart there, we have again those the Chittamatra and the Mahayana tenets here was founded by Asanga. Nagarjuna founded the Middle Way, but it needed further propounding upon. Buddhapalita gave the correct view, the Prasangika view, but then Bhavaviveka came along and countered with the Svatantrika view. Well, Chandrakirti decided that he needed to put the nail in the coffin, in a sense, and he wrote his own commentary. First of all, he did write Clear Words, which is a commentary on Nagarjuna, but then he wrote the text that we are studying a portion of, which is called the Madhyamakavatara, the supplement to the Middle Way. It's not a commentary on the Middle Way. It's actually a supplement. It adds some additional information, in a sense, to what Nagarjuna spelled out. So it is a form of commentary, but again, it's not a verse-by-verse commentary. It is more of, again, separate topics that the Chandrakirti enhanced and elaborated on. So it says this was developed, as it says there, to counter the views of both Chittamatra, mind-only, and the other school of the Middle Way, the Svatantrika Madhyamaka that Bhavaviveka founded, and to establish the Prasangika Madhyamaka view. So this is really an important point, and this is the text that actually gets studied in all of the Tibetan Buddhist monasteries now for the Middle Way point of view. It's poor Buddhapalita. I mean, he did an excellent job, they say, of kind of elaborating on what Nagarjuna had written and really refining the view so that it would be upheld. But then because Bhavaviveka challenged that, then Chandrakirti came along and put Bhavaviveka in his place and upheld Buddhapalita. But Chandrakirti's text has now become the one that everybody studies in the monasteries, and consequently it's the one that we studied in the master's program. It's an amazing text, and I'll talk a little bit about the structure of the text and what else is in it, just so you have some idea. We won't be getting into that content of the text, but if you do decide to read Thupten Jinpa's new translation of Tsongkhapa's commentary, at least you'll have some idea of what you're heading into. But essentially, Chandrakirti's text is really well known and renowned, and it too was written in verse form, but Chandrakirti also did an auto-commentary or self-commentary where he himself commented on the verses. Now, when we talk about how is it a supplement, that next little part, next bullet point, his text supplements fundamental wisdom in both the two categories of the profound stages of the path, which is more about emptiness, even though Nagarjuna taught very clearly the wisdom that's in the Prajnaparamita Sutras, the wisdom that we need to realize in order to become a Buddha, in order to be liberated, whatever. This needed further elaboration in terms of techniques to develop that selflessness. One of the things that Chandrakirti devised in his text is what's often called the sevenfold reasoning, where he goes into another way of approaching emptiness with even greater ways of investigating so that it becomes much clearer to us, the emptiness that the Buddha taught, that Nagarjuna also was setting out in his text. But the other element in terms of supplementing is what we call the vast stages of the path. This is kind of like the diversity of things that are all involved in creating the result of Buddhahood, the many practices that lead to that result. So in a way, these are the two wings of the bird I mentioned earlier, the wisdom wing, which is the profound, and then the method, the compassionate method wing, which are the vast practices of the Bodhisattva. And so both of these are contained within Chandrakirti's text. So I do have a few more folks to talk about before we go on to talk a little bit about Chandrakirti's text. Lama Tsongkhapa, who I mentioned earlier, and of course you also should know who Lama Tsongkhapa is from being involved with the FTMT. He is the founder of the Gelug or Gelugpa tradition of Tibetan Buddhism. There are four main traditions within Tibet. There's sometimes even the original more shamanistic tradition that was there, the Bon, that is considered a fifth school of Buddhist thinking in Tibet. At least that's how His Holiness sort of sees it, because they got definitely influenced by Buddhism. But you have the Nyingmas, the Kagyus, the Sakyas, and then the Gelugpas. The Gelugpas were the last to form, and they formed after the death of Tsongkhapa. He lived until from 1357 to 1419. He wrote the text that we are going to be studying some passages from, the commentary. He wrote that a year before he passed away, and the year before he passed away. So essentially, it's one of the most refined views on emptiness and the wisdom that we need to realize that exists because of it coming so late in his career. He's an amazing scholar, Lama Tsongkhapa. Again, many of you know of his sort of history and where he came from and all the practices he did and what have you. I'm not going to go into so much of that tonight, but I will share a little slide of first Chandrakirti, again, with his approximate dates. And the text that we are studying, that we are looking at the verses of, is the Madhyamakavatara, the supplement to the middle way, the supplement to fundamental wisdom, in a sense, Nagarjuna's text on the middle way. And then Tsongkhapa. Tsongkhapa, the text we are studying is called Illumination of the Thought. The new translation by Thupten Jinpa calls it Illuminating the Intent. Different ways of translating the Tibetan, each of them very fine, you know, give a different connotation, but the author, of course, Lama Tsongkhapa. The other text, another person that you might hear about maybe a couple of times during this course, is Jetsun Choki Gyaltsen. Jetsun Choki Gyaltsen lived after Tsongkhapa. And of course, one of the main monasteries in the Gelug tradition is Sera Monastery. Well, Jetsun Choki Gyaltsen became the textbook writer for Sera Monastery, I think for both Sera J and Sera May. And his text is generally referred to as the general meaning commentary of the middle way. Now, we're not going to be referring to that quite so much because, again, it's a textbook for monastic studies, so it includes a lot of debates and a lot of these fine points that you can get into. We'll see a little bit of that coming up in our commentary, but we're not going to go down that avenue. That's like a whole other can of worms. But I will point out, while I'm talking about books and things and resources, this also is long out of print. Guy Newland did a translation. I'm assuming this was for his sort of thesis that is called the Compassion, a Tibetan Analysis. And he translated Jetsun Choki Gelson's section on these passages that we're going to look at, the verses we're going to look at. So we do have, again, that to refer to, and I'll share when I can things from this that might be relevant. But know that, again, this sort of thing is, the subtitle is a Buddhist monastic textbook. And that's because, again, it's used in the monasteries to give grist for the mill for them to really get in and debate things. And they put debate topics forward, just in Choki Gelson, so that you can really get in there and, you know, work on this material. And that's what they do in the monasteries. In the monasteries, they get roughly an hour of teaching every day, from what I hear. And they spend about 6 or more hours a day debating the material that they've heard. You know, and that's how it really sinks in for them. And you've got amazing Geshe's there at Kadampa Center. And we know Geshe's from around the world who have this real foundation of knowledge that they always have with them. Why? Because they learned it at that level. You know, and in the West, we don't do that sort of integrated approach, but nonetheless, it is good if you have people that you can discuss the Dharma with, at least to talk about the Dharma with each other. We may not be able to debate it in the way they do on the traditional debate grounds, but nonetheless, you know, find a way to integrate the material a little bit more. So that's kind of a who's who and where we're at in terms of this, you know, kind of looking at the text that we are approaching and the history of it, where it came in and the things that have happened to make that a cornerstone of monastic education. And when I studied it as part of the master's program, as I mentioned, it was the second of the 5 texts that we study over there. I remember Lama Yeshe, when he was trying to develop this type of education, he was calling it the Geshe program. He thought it would be good if we had our own sort of version of the Geshe program for Western students to study. But of course, that title is, we want to reserve that title in the Geluk tradition for those monks and nuns now who have completed the full studies, 20-some years of studies. So in the monasteries, they study this for a number of years. I don't know how many years in particular for Madhyamaka-Vatara. But in our over in Italy when we studied, again, it was only about a year and a half that we were able to study this text, which is great. It's wonderful to be able to spend that amount of time. But nonetheless, in a year and a half and receiving a couple of teachings every day and not really having that much opportunity to integrate it, I have to admit my knowledge isn't so perfect, but I'll try to share with you, you know, what I can. And as I said, maybe inspire you to pursue this type of study or to at least have an awareness of these sorts of texts that are really, really insightful. When you study at that kind of level, especially Tsongkhapa's commentaries that are so incredibly articulate and profound and kind of get to the meaning really quite easily, it's quite an experience. One thing I might point out before we go on to talk a little bit more about Chandrakirti's text is that from my perspective, and I have never really heard this from a Tibetan teacher, but it is interesting. You know how I mentioned earlier how in the Prajnaparamita Sutras, everything is really quite terse, very hard to sort of, you know, grasp the meaning of. The Nagarjuna expounds upon emptiness with his text, but that requires commentary. And then you have Chandrakirti and other people expounding upon that. And then you have Tsongkhapa expounding upon Chandrakirti. I kind of look at it sometimes and wonder if, like, maybe we're all just getting duller in terms of our own faculties and kind of, you know, not being able to really discern the meaning so easily. You know, they do say that we're living in what they often call degenerate times when wisdom is very hard to cultivate. And so we do need these types of commentaries. We do need people like Tsongkhapa who can expound upon, you know, all the various points of each of the verses. And then, of course, we also need the oral commentary from great masters. You know, I was taught this text by my precious guru, Geshe Jampa Gyatso, who passed away in 2007. And was an incredible guide through all 7 years of the master's program, and I'm completely indebted to him for helping me to get my head around this material. But anyway, that's enough of all of that. I just wanted to at least, again, introduce you to this text. So let's talk a little bit about the text itself and what the text is all about. We're going to be looking at these first few verses of chapter 1 of the text. The way that this text is structured is that it starts off in these beginning verses by talking about everything that's involved in creating a bodhisattva, and compassion being the main cause of a bodhisattva. This is the orientation that we're going to be looking at. And of course, compassion, as we know, is really central to the Buddhist path. And that was one of the things that I'm hoping to, again, provide even additional emphasis on as we go through this. But in terms of the structure of the text, it starts off way back kind of before somebody even becomes a bodhisattva. And again, and you become a bodhisattva when you develop what we call uncontrived or spontaneous bodhicitta. So we meditated a little bit on bodhicitta at the beginning of class tonight, but I'm sure most of you are aware that there are two main techniques to develop bodhicitta, the seven-point cause and effect, and then the equalizing and exchanging self and others. I'm not going to go into those as part of this because that's the whole course in and of itself, but they're in the Lamrim texts, Liberation in the Palm of Your Hand, other texts, Lama Tsongkhapa's Lamrim texts, wherever you can find those teachings, it's good if you haven't been exposed to them to look at those. Compassion is a part of that technique of developing bodhicitta. But when you've developed your bodhicitta to a degree where it's very firm in your mind due to having meditated on bodhicitta and used a very stable form of meditation, you develop what's called an uncontrived or spontaneous bodhicitta. That is the doorway through which you become a bodhisattva. Before that, we can think of ourselves as bodhisattvas and maybe bodhisattva wannabes, but technically you're not a bodhisattva until you have that spontaneous bodhicitta. Now, what does it mean to have it spontaneous? It means that, again, it will arise without needing to do those techniques of thinking about all sentient beings as having been your mother and the kindness that they showed you and da-da-da-da, everything that's in the one technique and, then, of course, everything involved in the other technique. We know these meditations from our past studies, it takes a lot of energy to kind of put in, meditate on these things and even get to a place where we begin to feel bodhicitta. The person who has spontaneous bodhicitta is with them all the time. It becomes sort of a part of the fabric of their minds, to where any being they see, they are instantly thinking about, I need to become enlightened for the benefit of that being. They don't have to think about how that being was their mother and so on. So this is what we mean as the doorway to the Mahayana path, to the Bodhisattva path. Now, Tsongkhapa is going to jump, or Chandrakirti is going to jump from that, like what happens before you become a Bodhisattva, all the way till what happens when you achieve your first direct realization of emptiness. So I'm going to pass this chart along as well. I realized after I had sent some of the materials to Donna to distribute that this would be a useful one for all of you to have as well. I've taught recently on grounds and paths, which is the topic that sort of goes through how this all unfolds for the bodhisattva. And there are some modifications I'd want to make to this chart, but nonetheless, it's good enough, you know, for us to work with in this. So if we look far to the left here, we'll see that there are these three things that we're going to be identifying, that Chandrakirti identifies as the causes of a bodhisattva. Of course, the first one, the most important one, great compassion, and we'll talk about that in a moment. These are what he talks about essentially in these first few verses, especially great compassion, as the causes that lead one to develop this uncontrived bodhicitta that causes you to become a bodhisattva, to enter the bodhisattva path. And in brief, I'm only going to be talking about this one little row here that's got the five paths, the path of accumulation, path of preparation, path of seeing, path of meditation, and then path of no more learning. Of course, I'll be corresponding some of this to the grounds, as they're called, but let's start at the beginning. After you become a bodhisattva, due to having this uncontrived bodhicitta, you enter what's called the path of accumulation, which has three levels, and you essentially are accumulating all this kind of positive potential through your vast practices of the bodhisattva, and then you are also beginning to accumulate your wisdom by analyzing the nature of reality and looking at the wisdom teachings on emptiness. You probably have done some of that prior to entering the path if you're a sharp faculty bodhisattva. We'll talk about that later. But the idea is that you haven't yet had a direct realization of emptiness. Eventually, you do get to a point where you have a pretty good understanding of it, an inferential realization that is grounded in a pretty stable mind, and that causes you to enter the path of preparation. Passive preparation is called that because it prepares you for that initial direct insight into emptiness. This is, again, one of the main topics of Buddhist teachings, is to achieve this realization that begins the process of clearing away all of the obscurations in our minds. Remember, in our meditation tonight, we looked at the idea of Buddha nature, that we all have a fundamentally pure mind that is obscured by various things, what we often call the afflictive obstructions and the knowledge obstructions. Well, we begin that process of moving, of removing those, when we have our first direct realization of emptiness. That happens at this point. It's got a circle 7 down here. And you enter then into what's called the path of seeing or insight. It is your first seeing of reality in that way that is non-conceptual, direct. That is a powerful state of mind that begins the process of removing these obscurations in your mind. When you go into your second meditation of realizing emptiness directly that has the power to remove the next level of the obstructions, you enter into the path of meditation. That's also when you come out of that meditation, you enter into what's called the second ground, the first ground having been mostly within the path of seeing. You go on then and have additional realizations, and it takes you through what are called the 10 grounds or bhumis, where the bodhisattva is always at the end of these developing a wisdom realizing emptiness that has greater power to remove more and more of the obstructions, subtler and subtler levels of obstructions. When you get to this point 8 here, you've actually removed everything that is called afflictive obstructions, which is what keeps you in samsara, and you begin to work on the 8th through the 10th grounds, what are called the knowledge obstructions, what keeps you from being a Buddha, what keeps you from actually having an omniscient mind of a Buddha. And in brief, what happens is you go through all these 10 grounds, you get to the end of the 10th ground, you generate the final wisdom in a continuum of the sentient being before becoming a Buddha that is the last antidote to the subtlest level. And then you enter into what's called the path of no more learning. You know, school's out for good. You don't have to do any more learning. You have generated all the wisdom there is to be generated. You are completely capable of benefiting all beings perfectly at that point. You have the omniscient mind of a Buddha. Okay, so back to Chandrakirti's text. Chandrakirti's text, as I said, starts over here on the left, talking about in these introductory verses all these important causes of a bodhisattva, but especially compassion. And then he jumps over these two paths, path of accumulation and preparation, and goes to the first ground. And the rest of the text is set out in terms of one chapter each for each of the grounds, and then a final chapter that is for the resultant state of Buddhahood, again, what we call the path of no more learning. Now, if you notice, it's kind of small here, but if you notice every one of these grounds, they've got a title for them, but they also have in parentheses, maybe I'll enlarge it a little bit here, in parentheses, now I've got to move it over a little bit, parentheses, there is a perfection. Most of you know the first six perfections, right? Generosity or giving, that's under the first ground. Ethics, morality, under the second. Patience, the third. Joyous effort, the fourth. Concentration, the fifth. And wisdom, the sixth. And you'll go, well, what are these other four? These other four are said to be an extension of the perfection of wisdom, but they are method, that skillful means that you have of benefiting others, prayer, power. And then finally, an exalted wisdom that is an even greater level of wisdom that is approaching the wisdom of a Buddha. Well, of these 10 grounds and the 10 perfections, the most important one, of course, is the perfection of wisdom, the Prajnaparamita. So the bulk of Chandrakirti's text is chapter 6. It has got the by far the most verses and by far the most commentary by all the great commentators because it is an exposition on how to realize the wisdom of emptiness. Now, we're not going to be able to go into all of that as part of this four-session course, but I wanted to give you the context for what Chandrakirti's text is all about. It's essentially a map or a guide to how to move through these stages of development from the first ground all the way through to Buddhahood and demonstrating all the various things that the bodhisattva practices along the way. So this is, again, why it also is supplementing the middle way, is that it's not just teaching the wisdom aspects that Nagarjuna taught about, but it's also teaching those, you know, vast practices of the Bodhisattva, how they develop their mind in this forward direction all the way to Buddhahood through these various grounds. So it's a really inspiring text to study, and again, I do hope all of you get a chance to study it at some point. I'm not discouraging you from picking up something like Illuminating the Intent, Thupten Jinpa's new translation of Tsongkhapa's commentary, and just sitting down and trying to read it, but recognize that there will be some points in there where you probably will need additional commentary. So it's ideal if you can eventually attain that in some way. As I said, it's in the monasteries, it's what everybody studies. All the monks and nuns who are destined for a Geshe degree all spend a lot of time investigating that text. So just know that, again, this is what Chandrakirti's text then is, once more, it's meant to supplement in terms of giving us more techniques to work with the vast wisdom of emptiness, but it's also in terms of the profound wisdom of emptiness, and also in terms of the vast teachings that support the path of the Bodhisattva, all the various practices that we engage in, motivated by compassion, that allow us, again, to unite these two, to unite the profound and the vast, the wisdom and the compassion, compassionate method. So maybe that's enough for this part of the introduction. When we come back, I do have a little bit more to talk about in regard to compassion, and that'll set the stage for going into the text. So it's about 7 after the hour here. I'll just change to 8. So let's take 10 minutes, and right around 18 after, I will ring the bell so you can keep your speaker on, and then that will round you all up. But we'll take a little 10-minute break for you to stretch, do whatever you need to do, and then we'll resume. Okay, good. So again, if you do have any questions, please feel free to use the chat box. So let me just check in with the agenda that I had for tonight. I forgot to put that up at one point. And by the way, I have passed along this chart to Donna, so she will make sure that it gets out there for people to be able to access. Here's our little course outline that, again, I also supplied that to Donna. So tonight we've touched on, I think, everything on here except the last of these points. I think I did pretty good at sort of staying on track even without my little outline. We'll talk a little bit about compassion next, and then, as I said, if we do have any extra time before we do Q&A, I might start going into an exposition of the text, explaining the text a bit. There are essentially 5 parts to the text that we're going to be looking at, even though, again, this only covers 3.5 verses. The first verse a little bit longer than the other ones, but essentially there's not that much information word-wise when it comes to it, but in terms of content and really getting into talking about them, these 5 topics are what we're going to be looking at. So this is what we're going to cover over the next 3 Thursdays, and again, I'll spend different time on each of these topics. When we get to the final one, the 3 types of compassion, that's really the, as I said, the main one that talks about this whole idea of uniting wisdom and compassion and bringing those meditations together. So let's talk a little bit about compassion using once more the first of the 4 handouts, the second page, where it says discussion of compassion. And I want to just talk terminology again. Most of us know some of these terms, but it's good to review them. To start with, the term that we often call compassion, sometimes translated as mercy when we use one of the other Tibetan words for it. Ningje is one that's usually translated as compassion. And then sewa. By the way, these, if you're not familiar with Wiley is a system of being able to use English alphabet to reference the Tibetan letters. So they're not the way it's pronounced necessarily, though there are some times when it's close, like in Ningje. Ningje is how it's spelled in terms of the Wiley, referring to the Tibetan characters, and it's also how it's pronounced. But then for mercy, Tsewa. Tsewa is, again, obviously not exactly what that looks like. That looks like Rseba or whatever. You know, mercy and compassion are equivalent in this context. Ningje or Tsewa, they're both referring to the same thing. And essentially, compassion, we could roughly define divine as the heartfelt wish that sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. Again, compassion can be directed at the sentient being that is yourself, what we call self-compassion. That's a good part of our path in the Lam Rim, developing compassion for ourselves by clearly understanding our own situation. But then, of course, we enlarge that compassion to include others and to want them as well to be free from suffering and all the causes of suffering. Great compassion, which again would be the above terms followed by Chenpo. Chen means great, but sometimes it's even abbreviated like Sechen. Sechen Ling is the center in San Francisco where I studied initially with the FPMT before I went off to the master's program. And as I mentioned, I taught this topic to them many years ago and just recently also had a chance to reteach it there. But essentially, yeah, this is sometimes abbreviated then to like Sechen, to be great compassion. So what do we mean by great compassion? As it's described there, great compassion is distinguished not only by embracing all sentient beings as its object, because most beings have some level of compassion. You know, even somebody who's got a pretty rough edge to them, they might still have compassion for their pets or for their loved ones or whatever. But this is, first of all, embracing all sentient beings without exception as the object of that compassion. But also, this compassion is greater or more than mere compassion, in that it also encompasses a second aspect of aspiring to actually protect beings from suffering. That is, to remove them from that state of suffering. So this is the compassion that Chandrakirti is paying homage to in the beginning of his text. Now, great compassion, as distinguished from mere compassion, is only really taught in the Mahayana tradition. In the Hinayana tradition, they learn about compassion. They even practice what's called immeasurable compassion, where they do enlarge it to include all beings. But they never get to that place, at least in the traditional teaching, this is how it's described. They never get to that place that great compassion is at, where they take that personal responsibility, where they say, I myself will do this. So we see the importance of this mind feeding into bodhicitta. You know, bodhicitta isn't based on just the compassionate wish, thinking, oh, may all these beings be free from suffering. You know, how wonderful that they never had to suffer. It's saying, I need to do that for them. I need to help them to be free from suffering. So it's very much about taking that once more universal responsibility. So already in great compassion, you have that universal idea of, I'm going to do this for all beings. But of course, it gets advanced into bodhicitta when we recognize that in order for us to make that compassion sort of validated, we have to achieve a state where we can protect others from suffering, which of course is a state of Buddhahood, where we can then, you know, impart the Dharma to them perfectly in accord with their karma and help them on their path of awakening. And until they fully awaken, they won't be freed from suffering, you know, or, you know, from all the obscurations in the mind. So when we talk about great compassion, we are talking about something that is unique to the Mahayana. And in those techniques for developing bodhicitta that I mentioned earlier, it is great compassion that we are cultivating. It's always the idea that it's not just enough to not want sentient beings to suffer, to want them to be free from the causes of suffering, but rather we have to take on that responsibility to do that for them. So that's, again, to distinguish what's being talked about here. We're not talking about mere compassion in this praise, this homage to compassion that we're going to be discussing over these classes. The other term that you probably have heard, of course, loving kindness, which is said to be sort of a companion to great compassion or to compassion, it's jhampa in the Tibetan. And love or loving kindness is the counterpart. The wish for sentient beings to have happiness and the causes of happiness. When it has the aspect of aspiring to place all beings in happiness and the causes of happiness, it then becomes great love. So this is, once more, we can distinguish both of those, that love that advances to the degree where we want to place beings in happiness and the causes of that as being a unique part of the Mahayana and not really taught in the Hinayana. Again, they will have immeasurable love and want all beings to have that happiness, but they don't go to that degree of saying, and I will place them in happiness. I will do whatever it takes to make sure that every being attains the happiness that they seek and has all the causes that lead to that. So again, we're not going to touch on great love so much, but know that both of these are factors that kind of are involved in developing bodhicitta. You know, and they are companions, right? One is looking at sentient beings from the point of view of their suffering and they don't want to suffer. And the other one is looking at it from the point of view of they want happiness, but they're not really there yet. They haven't achieved any lasting peace and happiness. So it's just the situation of beings from two different perspectives. I brought this up in the last time that I taught on this subject, which is, and I bring it up frequently when I teach on compassion, why is compassion singled out more so than love? I mean, they do have a very different flavor, right? When we meditate on love, the mind feels a bit lighter, right? You know, because we're thinking about, oh, all beings being happy. You know, it's kind of like seeing them in a state of the fulfillment of their, you know, deepest wish for well-being or something. You know, it's just very kind of beautiful meditation. They say meditating on love is one of the major antidotes to all of our sort of kind of depression or things that might get us down, is to think of love, to think about generating that loving kindness towards other beings. But nonetheless, it does have a very different flavor to it from compassion. Compassion in the that word in the English language is derived from the Latin compati, to be with suffering, to be with the suffering of another, which of course doesn't feel so good sometimes. That's why compassion is a bit of a challenge to maintain and to develop, is because we have to be willing to have that empathic connection with others, to really feel their suffering as if it were our own, as if we were the ones going through that experience. Whereas when we're generating love and we're having empathy with other beings, well, then we're sharing in that wonderful space of them being happy and delighted and having all these great things going on. With compassion, we're down in the dirty stuff, you know, all of the muck and the, you know, horrible things of samsara, and it really does take a lot of energy to sustain it. It has a more visceral feeling to it, compassion, than what loving kindness does in many ways. So again, I if we look at it once more, the Buddha's very first teaching, when he taught the first of the Four Noble Truths, the truth of suffering or dukkha, he wasn't, you know, isolating out that we need to look at sentient beings from the perspective of them lacking happiness. He was saying, let's look at them from the perspective of how they are suffering, how they are in an unsatisfactory state, because that's a much more and visceral motivating force. It's something that really gets us involved in the suffering of others and wanting to do something about it. So I'm not, you know, in any way trying to diminish the effect and the power of meditating on love, but compassion is often, as we see in this text, singled out as the main source of all of the progress on the path for whoever. All of the various realizations are rooted in compassion. This compassion can has that sort of quality that really does take us out of ourselves and make us concerned about the welfare of other beings, which is the essence of the Mahayana. So let's look at the other aspect that we need to be aware of in terms of when we talk about compassion. What are we, you know, kind of observing? What is it that we are thinking of in terms of the suffering of others? Because if we're limited in what we're understanding about the suffering of others, then we're only going to have a very limited form of compassion. So again, all right here from the beginning, this first class, we are informing our compassion with wisdom by understanding the varieties of sufferings that exist, or dukkha, as the Buddha taught in the Sanskrit, this word that means, it's translated as suffering, but it often means a bigger view of the dissatisfaction that beings experience, the unsatisfactory state that they're in. So let's look at what it says here on the screen. The basis of compassion is twofold. There is first that factor of empathy or closeness to all other beings, which those techniques I talked about earlier in generating bodhicitta do have their way of helping us to feel close to others. Again, by thinking about them as having been our mother or someone very dear to us, and so on. That is a key component to this. We have to care about the suffering of those beings. But secondly, as it says here, we have to have the recognition of the extent of the suffering that those beings are experiencing. So let's go through this list of the three types of suffering. Again, most of you have heard this before, but I want to share them again tonight anyway. The first is often referred to as manifest dukkha, or suffering of suffering, suffering of pain. This is the most obvious way that beings are suffering, and they're not suffering this way all the time, most of them. But this includes any mental or physical what we often call suffering in our culture. It's pain, it's anguish, it's the unpleasant experiences. So it encompasses, it says there, the misery and pains of illness, aging, and death, as well as separation from people or objects that we love, having to meet those things that we don't like, and so forth. Now, this is really obvious or evident suffering. It is obvious to almost everyone, so we easily recognize it as suffering, and we, of course, want to be free of that. Now, by putting it in this sort of first category, it's not to diminish the importance of seeing that suffering. Some people don't even have a compassion that opens up to the manifest suffering of others. Maybe they only, you know, have their heart open when they see themselves or those that they love dealing with this form of suffering. But this is often a touchstone to help us to get involved with the suffering of others when we see them having that type of experience that is painful and difficult. Take it off screen for just a moment and talk about one teaching from Venerable Pema Chodron. Most of you know Pema Chodron. She, I think it's her book, Start Where You Are, and she recounts the story that Chogyam Trungpa, her initial teacher in Buddhism, gave to her, and as well as, you know, other students that were present, that he would always get the sort of wellspring of compassion going by recalling an incident that he saw when he was a young boy in Tibet. And it was actually of a bunch of other young kids stoning a puppy to death, which is really hard to even talk about, think about. But he would bring that to mind, that image, and the compassion he felt at that time watching the suffering of that being. And, of course, of all the beings that were cruelly doing this to this animal. And he would immediately open up the wellspring of compassion and feel it, you know. So we do see that this first type of suffering is an important one, because oftentimes this is how we get sort of the compassion juices flowing or whatever. We get that response by recognizing this really in-your-face way that people are suffering, that beings are suffering. It does help us to kind of break out of that shell of not caring, of, you know, having a lack of concern. But nonetheless, it's just the tip of the iceberg. It's that more manifest way that we can see that beings are suffering. So, again, let's go on to the second and third. Again, those of you who've heard this before, just stick with me and maybe give some different insights by looking at the way I'm presenting it. But the second one is often called the dukkha, or the suffering of change. This suffering refers to what we usually call pleasure or happiness. And it is identified as suffering because such pleasure has the ability to turn into pain, and it will turn into pain if we sustain it. We're not equating a pleasurable feeling to a suffering or a painful feeling. We're saying that that pleasurable feeling isn't true pleasure and actually has the potential to become pain. Look at the second point under that. Because all objects of enjoyment and pleasure lack any inherent nature to bring happiness, their continued experience has the potential to eventually lead to suffering. So let's look at an example for this. And this was one that I seem to recall my teacher, Geshe-Jean Pigiazzo, in Italy, teaching on this. In Italy, we were at the Istituto Lama Tsongkhapa in Pomaya, which is, I don't know, maybe about 10 miles from the Mediterranean. And, of course, when the weather would start getting warm before we had our summer break in July, I think we had about 8 weeks from mid-July to mid-September, you know, people would start wanting to head down to the beach, you know, to have some fun at the beach. So you've got, you know, all of you have gone to the beach or to a lakefront or something, you know, to do this sort of thing. So you go out there, and maybe it's one of those days where there's a bit of a breeze, but the sun is really quite bright. So you lay on a towel, and you get really warm from the sun, and you're having such a good time in the sun, but then it starts to get a little hot. So then you run into the water, right? And you immerse yourself in the water, and the cool water feels so good. And then eventually, you know, because there's a breeze and because the water is maybe not as warm as you thought it was initially, you start to get, you know, goose pimples, and you're getting a chill. So you run back out into the sun, and you lay in the sun, and then you get warm again, and then you get too hot, and then you run back into the water. Well, we call that having fun at the beach, right? But it's not really pleasure, because it's changing. if we lay in the sun long enough, the heat becomes unbearable, and we have to get into the cool, the shade, or into the water. And then when we get into that and it starts to become too cool, then we have to run back into the sun. And this is how we manage everything, is through moderation, through kind of doing just enough to get to a point where, you know, it doesn't become excessive, and then we go to the thing that becomes the relief we need at that time, and then we go to the thing that becomes the relief. This is how we manage that pain, or that suffering, sorry, not pain. This suffering of change is speaking to the fact that these things in and of themselves are not true sources of pleasure. Why? Because then you could lie out in the sun for as long as you wanted, and you'd only get happier and happier, more and more blissful. Like, oh, the sunshine is so great, it just keeps making me happier and happier, as, you know, your skin's getting red and burning or whatever. So the idea is, again, that these things don't have the ability to create the lasting pleasure that we seek. And they will lead to pain. And they're transitory. They are, you know, experiences that we have that don't really last. I sometimes joke with people that if I were to offer you right now a piece of cake, and you can make it chocolate cake or carrot cake or lemon cake or whatever cake you really like, and you were to be able to tell me, no, thank you, I don't need a piece because I had one many years ago and I'm still experiencing the joy from that, the bliss from that. You know? But we know that's not the case, right? Somebody offers us cake, we're like, yeah, I'll take another piece. And we get that pleasure from it, that, you know, putting that cake on our tongue and tasting it and eating it, the whole experience. And then it goes away. And then we need it again. And then we need it again and again and again. That's another way we can see the unsatisfactory nature of these pleasurable experiences. They're not filling the bill. They're not doing what it is that we think they should do. But again, we accept this. And then most people in the world just kind of accept it and acknowledge that they'll just have their piece of cake every now and then that'll keep them with that experience somewhat fresh in their mind. And they don't question it. Well, the Buddha questioned it, and he said, let's take a real hard look at what these pleasurable experiences are. And let's come to the conclusion, based on that reasoning and that analysis and looking at them, that they are transitory, they don't last, and secondly, they don't have the ability to create more pleasure. They actually create pain when we sustain them over time. So that's the second one. That's a really important one to get. As I said on the screen here, you know, this is generally not recognized as suffering or dukkha, you know, and so it's more difficult to realize as such. Let's go to the next one, the last one. This has got different names. Lama Zopa Rinpoche calls this pervasive compounding suffering, like a compounding interest on an account, you know, where it keeps compounding more and more on top of it. And there's some, you know, relevance to that, because our suffering only gets greater in some sense the longer that we stay in the state that we're in. So let's look at the first bullet point. Essentially, this refers to our unenlightened existence, wherein we are under the influence of a process that is not under our own control. We are under the control of our delusions and the karma, the actions we create that shape our experiences. So, second bullet point, it involves the fact that we are ruled by our karma and afflictive emotions and their underlying root cause, which is our basic ignorance of the nature of reality, which once more is what is addressed by in the Prajnaparamita Sutras that Nagarjuna expounded upon in Fundamental Wisdom, that Chandrakirti is elaborating on, supplementing with this text. So essentially, we need to realize emptiness. The wisdom realizing emptiness is essential to overcoming this very subtle form of suffering that's with us all the time. Sometimes I refer to this as 24/7 suffering or dukkha. You never have a vacation. You know, this is the most difficult of the three types of suffering to realize. Speaking of never having a vacation, that is actually the one line I remember from the very first time I saw Lama Zopa Rinpoche at Seichen Ling back in December of 1996. It was an evening teaching, and I don't know how long he taught, but I just couldn't get an ear for Rinpoche at all. But he had that one line where he said, in samsara, there is no vacation. And it just like really stuck with me. Because, you know, we like to think that we can go on vacation and get away from things, but you take it all with you, right? Your delusions and your karma and everything, it all plays out in terms of that experience, and it doesn't go away. You can't leave it at home and go on vacation without all of that. There's not one moment's break from all of that that we've ever experienced. this beginningless time, which of course is the horizon that the Buddha is talking about here. We've been in this state of being controlled by those factors, our own delusions rooted in our ignorance that give rise to the actions we engage in, our karma that ripen into our experiences being those other two types of suffering, the painful experiences, the pleasant experiences. Of course, we also have neutral experiences, but those aren't so problematic because we don't really have a lot of mind bending around that. They might dull us out a bit, but mostly we're vacillating around the pleasant and the unpleasant, the really delicious, happy, wonderful experiences and the painful, awful, miserable experiences, and these two causing us to get caught up in creating a lot of negative karma because we get attachment to the pleasant, we have anger towards what is unpleasant. So this is our fundamental situation, this third one, the pervasive conditioned suffering. It pervades every realm of existence and every moment of every realm of existence. You're never free from it. And it's conditioned because this is how we're under the control of these conditions. We've never known freedom from the shackles of samsara. You know, we're always being influenced by our karma and our delusions. So this is the idea behind that. Let me go back to the handout just to finish this off. So, as it says there, to develop any lasting compassion or wisdom, it is especially important to understand this third level of suffering or dukkha. With that understanding, in conjunction with developing loving kindness for all beings, one can proceed to develop great compassion. You know, if we only want beings to be free of the suffering of pain, well, then that's all that's going to trigger that for us. You know, we're only going to have compassion when we see beings who are right there in the moment having to experience something painful, difficult. And that's going to be very limiting again. And if we only take in then the second type where we see them when they are pleasant, well, then we can enlarge our compassion. We can think about even those people who are really well off in the world, who have bountiful resources and kind of mask their suffering by continually having the joys of samsara, all these pleasures. We can see that they're in an awful state as well. But until we get the idea and the understanding that all beings are under the control of these factors, and that they therefore don't really have any freedom at all, they're always going to inevitably experience some form of pain. And so as we look at sentient beings and have that understanding of their suffering, we of course have a greater compassion for them, and we can enlarge our compassion to include all beings, whether they're manifesting pain, suffering or not. So this is already once more informing this a little bit. This we're going to get into a little bit more when we talk about the first of the three types of compassion later in this course. But I wanted to introduce this idea of seeing the extent of which to which sentient beings are suffering right up front so that we don't get some understanding of compassion that's not complete. Again, compassion has to be great compassion in this context, meaning that it goes beyond just the mere desire that beings not suffer, takes personal responsibility for removing them from that, and moreover, sees the extent to which beings are suffering. And it's motivated, once more, by that feeling of closeness. Again, we're not going to talk about that maybe quite so much in this course, but know that that is a really essential part. These are always highlighted in all the Lamrim texts. His Holiness the Dalai Lama, I think it's his book, An Open Heart, he talks about how having an understanding of the suffering of other beings isn't enough because we really do need to feel that empathic connection with them. We need to have some concern, some regard for their suffering. Because we see, especially with people who we don't like, we might even take joy when they're suffering. I hate to say it, that does happen often, right? That sort of a Schadenfreude, I think it's called in German, where you take delight in another person's suffering. A horrible thing to do. So we need to adjust our minds to see the reality of the suffering of all beings and to feel some connection to them, some concern for them. You know, to recognize that those beings who have that persona now that is challenging and difficult for us, that again, they have been someone very dear and close to us, and we need to see them through a different lens so that we don't close our hearts to them. So there's a lot more factors involved in compassion that we won't be getting involved in as much in this course, but I will be again using what Chandrakirti says in his verses as a means of helping to unite some of the wisdom teachings with this compassion that each of us already has, but we need to advance to that degree. So let's see, it's about 1:45. I noticed that there were at least one or two questions in here. Let me go back to the one question that had to do with about Lama Tsongkhapa. And, you know, it was mentioned a sadhana of Lama Tsongkhapa. I'm not sure I've seen a sort of sadhana per se. There's the Lama Tsongkhapa Guru Yoga, which FPMT published many years ago, and is, of course, available from FPMT, from the resources and what have you. And this is usually what people, when they talk about doing a practice of Lama Tsongkhapa on a regular basis, this is usually what they point to, is what's called Lama Tsongkhapa Guru Yoga. And the question, I think, had to do with what's the sort of source of that, the date of that, or, you know, where did it come from, and the benefits of doing that practice. And it was in the context of that particular person who put the question there, having had some years of practice with the new Kadampa tradition, which is a tradition that was formed by a former teacher of the FPMT many years ago, who broke away based on some issue that was arising within the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, particularly the Gelugpa tradition of Tibetan Buddhism. And they follow the teachings of Lama Tsongkhapa, but they're on the sort of on the outs with His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and certainly with Lama Zopa Rinpoche and FPMT, because of them adhering to a practice that has been deemed by His Holiness not so beneficial to do. Nonetheless, they are teaching the same Dharma in a sense. They're teaching Lama Tsongkhapa's teachings. It's not to say that the teachings that if anyone has gone to that tradition, that you should discard all those teachings. They're replicated in the FPMT. It's good to maybe look at the sources in the FPMT for obtaining teachings on those same topics, but not to, again, completely discard them simply because of this dispute that has gone on. But I don't know, again, maybe I need more information to know exactly what the sadhana is, but if we're talking about this Guru Yoga, which is, again, one daily practice to work with Tsongkhapa as the founder of this tradition, it said that it was originally composed by Dolnagpa Paul Done, who I believe was sometime in the late 15th, early 16th century, who was essentially putting together a practice to work with Tsongkhapa because of the strong lineage that formed after Tsongkhapa's death in 1419. The benefits, of course, of this type of practice is that whenever we do anything that we call a guru yoga, the word yoga comes from the same Sanskrit word like yoke, Y-O-K-E, which is to join, to bring things together. So whenever we have guru yoga, the concept behind it is that we are trying to bring our minds and the guru's mind together. Now, what are the gurus? The gurus are those beings who are in this world who play a really prominent role in our spiritual development. And there are a lot of teachings on the gurus and how to perceive the gurus and what have you. What creates a guru? Well, you create a guru, in a sense. It's your own karma that creates those beings that play that prominent role in your own spiritual development. But it's good to explore teachings on guru relationships and making sure that you have your eyes wide open for what you're entering into with regard to that. But when we start to rely upon those spiritual guides in a very intimate way, where they are really the ones helping us to follow this path, then it's good to work with these practices to create that kind of a connection, even when we're not in their presence. You know, so even with my teacher having passed away in 2007, I try to do practices that he initiated me into that keep that connection going, that keep the guru kind of alive. Now, the whole purpose of an outer guru, as they often say, is to awaken the inner guru, to awaken your own inner wisdom and compassion. And so the role that those beings play aren't like that they have some sort of magic wand or something and suddenly, poof, we're enlightened. They help us by being a sort of a mirror and something to keep reflecting the teachings back at us so that we go through our own process of awakening. And so gurus play a key role in the Tibetan Buddhist path, but they play a role in almost every spiritual tradition to some degree. And doing a guru yoga, a practice around Lama Tsongkhapa, is where you think of Lama Tsongkhapa as being the heart guru to some degree of this tradition that we are following, and being the same essence then as our own gurus, as His Holiness the Dalai Lama, or Lama Zopa Rinpoche, or whoever we feel we have that kind of connection with. So I don't know, maybe that's enough on that in terms of the importance of that type of practice, but I think it is really good to pursue these sorts of things as you can, maybe even to do a retreat occasionally where you work with Lama Tsongkhapa Guru Yoga or other practices that are around that, the Guru Puja, Lama Chopa. Lots of different practices we have in our tradition that are very much about opening ourselves up to the influence of the gurus. So another question, once we have had a pleasurable experience, there is suffering chasing that experience again, and often the second or third time it is not as good, so suffering or disappointment, or we have that disappointment. This is what we actually do see, right? And oftentimes, well, there's that song, I don't know, maybe it's the wrong thing to bring up in a Buddhist teaching, maybe I'm not thinking of the right song, but there's that idea of like the first time is the best or something, or like, I don't know, is it kind of like when you initially do something, if there's something that's so wonderful and magical about it, then when you try it again, it's never as good as the first time? That's the song. I knew there was a song out there somewhere. But the idea is that we do have this relationship with our pleasurable experiences, right? Where there's that kind of newness and freshness that we want to experience. Look at how so many people spend so much of their life trying to get something that is like a new experience, something, you know, they haven't done yet. I remember when bungee jumping was really popular. I had a good friend of mine that wanted me to go bungee jumping with him, and I just said, no, thank you. I don't need to have that experience. On my deathbed, I'm not going to go, oh, damn, I should have gone bungee jumping. It's just not going to happen. So I didn't go that route. But, you know, this is the whole thing is these experiences, they don't live up. You have that one experience, and then the next time it's not quite as good, and the next time it's not even anywhere near as good, and then before you know it, you've left it, and you've gone on to something else. You know, you want that new, fresh experience, what have you. There's a comment that also was made in terms of the NKT teachers and having, you know, only maybe 6 months study. I think it is really important, kind of jumping back to the guru teachings, but it is really important when you are seeking someone to play that role for you, to really check them out. His Holiness the Dalai Lama says we should check out a teacher for 12 years before we commit to them as our guru. Now, most of us don't feel like we have 12 years of our life to do that, but at least spend some time. Don't spend 12 minutes, you know, or 12 seconds. You know, at least spend a year, 2 years, 3 years being in their presence, seeing what it's like to learn from them. You don't, a guru-disciple commitment is made from your side when you feel ready to make that. And of course, there are some things like taking a tantric initiation or what have you that make that person into your guru. But that should be a conscious decision that you're making in terms of seeing that person as a reliable guide, somebody who has greater knowledge than you, who you have confidence in their skills and abilities and the way that they are practicing the Dharma themselves. You know, when you have that confidence, then they're a good person for you. And they might only play a role for some portion of the path. And then maybe you find another being that will be the person that gets you to the next level. Don't think that you're looking for necessarily just one person to play that role, but do check up. And again, in the Lamrim teachings, the stages of the path teachings, the 10 qualities of a guru, a Mahayana guru, are set out for you. So you got your shopping list, you know, you got your 10 things you're looking for, and then you start checking up. And, you know, there is that phrase, when the student is ready, the teacher will appear, right? You know, but that doesn't mean you sit in your house and just wait for the doorbell to ring. You know, it's not going to happen. Gurus don't go, you know, door to door soliciting, would you like to be my disciple? You know, it'd be kind of weird, I suppose. But just know that you have to sort of get out there yourself, create that kind of desire to connect with those beings from your side, and check up those teachers. When you just sit in a teaching, you know, like this or any other teaching that you're doing in person or online, and you're just sort of checking up the teachings and getting teachings from somebody, that doesn't make them into your guru. What makes them into your guru is the decision that you want them as a guru, and you will engage in various things that will solidify that relationship on the basis of your taking teachings from them, possibly taking initiations, vows, other things from them. But just know that, again, we should be very careful in terms of who we're learning the Dharma from, and, you know, and that goes for me too. You know, check me out before even just, you know, receiving these teachings. Not that you're going to see me as your guru, that's not part of this equation, but just the idea of, again, always use your own intellect and your own investigation into these teachings, and let that be the real guide, the real measure of the worth of these teachings. The Buddha himself said this. There's that one sutra that's quite renowned where he says, treat my teachings like a goldsmith would treat what is considered to be gold ore. If somebody came to him and said, oh, I've got some gold ore, you want to buy this? Well, the goldsmith doesn't take it for granted that it's gold ore. He cuts it, he burns it, he rubs it. And if it behaves like gold ore, then it is gold ore. And he's happily, you know, buying it and accepting it. But if it's not, if it doesn't behave that way, then discard it. There's no point in buying it. There's no point in subscribing to it. So again, this is the measure we have to bring to the Buddhist teachings all the time, the willingness to put the time in and investigate the teachings. So, again, I'm just reading some more of what comes in here. Yeah, be sort of mindful of this, you know, division that exists between the NKT and the larger body of the Gelugpa tradition. But, you know, I try to see it as like, again, this is like Clash of the Titans, something going on at another level that I'm like way, way beneath. And just stay kind of focused on what it is that you find that resonates with you and that you find is helpful for your own mind. And again, don't get too caught up in some of that. Let me just open it up. I don't know if there's anything more in the chat box that I've missed. If there is, please let me know. But is there anything anyone wanted to come on screen and ask a question about, or anyone? No? It is a little intimidating to come on screen. But again, feel free to use the chat box for these sessions to put questions in. And certainly if something comes up over the next week, you go, wow, Don said that, but I'm thinking about it. And, you know, then by all means, just put that in the chat box right at the beginning, and then I'll make sure that I address it at some point in the teaching. So nothing from anyone else? Okay, so again, well, let's just a kind of a recap of tonight. We did a little bit of this introductory material just to get us our heads into what we're looking at in this course. I hope you're still interested based on what I said tonight. I hope this does give you the objectives that I'm setting for this, the idea of, again, uniting wisdom and compassion through understanding some of the wisdom teachings that the Buddha gave that can inform your compassion to an even greater degree, strengthen it, make it really quite powerful. And then also, of course, to understand the importance of compassion in the entire path. That's what we're going to look at next when we go into the first part of this text. We're going to see that of all the things that are involved in the Buddhist path, Chandrakirti chose this great compassion to pay homage to. Why? Because it's at the root of everything that good that comes about through the Buddhist path. That's the first part we're going to look at next week. Then the other idea that we want to make sure we kind of have as an objective is that you get some flavor for this type of investigation into Buddhist teachings using a commentary, the appreciation for Chandrakirti's texts, for Lama Tsongkhapa's amazing scholarship and his ability to explain these teachings so well. I don't have to do much. Just read Tsongkhapa and maybe say a few words here and there. But essentially, this is what we're going to be doing over these next remaining sessions. So, and I may trim a few things based on my recent experience of having taught it, especially with just the limited sessions that we have, just to make sure that we do have some time, especially to focus on that last part of the text where we do bring in these wisdom teachings that are so essential to deepening our compassion. So, all right, so no other questions or comments. Let's go ahead and do some prayers. All right, let me pull that up on screen. I'll have to get back to, there they are. Okay, so again, we're going to do the two dedication prayers are on the screen here. The first four lines, the dedication where we think about our motivation of bodhicitta and we reconnect with it. And we think very strongly, may what we've done here tonight that was informed by bodhicitta bring about the result that bodhicitta is seeking, our own enlightenment and the enlightenment of all beings that will follow from that. The second group of four lines is where we recall bodhicitta and its power. And make this sincere wish as we're reciting this, that bodhicitta not just develop in your own heart, but that it develop in the hearts of all beings, especially those who are difficult in our world, who are causing pain and suffering to others. If they had bodhicitta, what an amazing transformation it would be for them and for the world we live in. Due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the supreme jewel bodhicitta that has not arisen arise and grow, and may that which has arisen not diminish but increase more and more. And we'll do some prayers for our teachers with the idea of gurus, and whether these are your gurus or not. We want to create the causes for these beings to be in this world, for them to have good health and long lives, because that's coming from our side. You know, we have to create that type of energy that wants spiritual guides in our lives. So as we recite these prayers for His Holiness, for Kyabje Zopa Rinpoche, our spiritual director, as well as for Tenzin Osohita, Lama Yeshe's reincarnation, extend this out to other teachers as well, those that you know, Geshe Gelug and Geshe Sangpo there at Kadampa, as well as all the other teachers that we have a connection with. Think that through making these prayers for these three teachers, we create the causes for all spiritual guides in all traditions to have good health and long lives, and for us and others to never be parted from perfect guides. The wish-granting, wish-fulfilling jewel, source of every single benefit and happiness in this world, to the incomparably kind Tenzin Gyatso, I beseech, may all your holy wishes be spontaneously fulfilled. You who uphold the subduer's moral way, who serve as the bountiful bearer of all, sustaining, preserving, and spreading Manjunath's victorious doctrine, who masterfully accomplish magnificent prayers honoring the three jewels, Savior of myself and others, your disciples, please, please live long. Venerable One, to you whose kindness exceeds that of all the conquerors for those wanderers in far-off places, especially the West, mindful of your loving concern for us in intentionally descending again into a family of a far-distant land, we make this request. O Lama, please, please live long. And lastly, we dedicate for all those beings that we're holding in our hearts that we already do have compassion for, those beings that we know of, whose situation we're aware of, who are experiencing obstacles, illness, who are dying or who have died, but also those other beings that we know of because we've heard on the news about the suffering that's going on with the collapsed building in Surfside, Florida, with the extreme temperatures that we're having in the Northwest, with whatever, the pandemic still raging in so many parts of this world. If there are those sorts of pockets of people that we want to think about as well, we can bring them to mind. But share this positive energy with all of these beings so that they become free from their suffering immediately. Have that strong thought. May they be free from it right now. And may they find all the causes that will bring them to perfect peace and happiness. And then may this be so for all beings, for what we've done here tonight. Wonderful. Thank you all so much. I'm enjoying this course and teaching, sharing this with all of you, and it's great to be back with all of you. So again, if you'd like to, over the next week, meditate on compassion using those three types of suffering. And you can stay with just those beings that you feel a connection with, but try to see that you can have, you know, kind of a deeper understanding of the way that they're suffering by not just looking at those who are experiencing pain or difficulty at this time. Okay. All right. Kevin, yeah, please. You wanted to make a comment?
I wanted to ask, is this available on YouTube in a couple of days so I can watch again?
Donna, would you like to address that?
It's live streaming at the moment, Kevin, so you can immediately after class, if you want to, go to our website and watch it on YouTube.
Okay. So I will watch it in a couple of days and I've probably thought about what the teachings have been and go over what I'm not sure about.
Okay.
That's how I did it with Venerable George when he was teaching tennis, because that was a really difficult course. And it let me off the exam, because I will have been in lockdown 9 months by October when I get vaccinated.
Oh, wow. Yeah. No, and again, with teachings like Tenets or even this course that does have a bit more technical stuff, it's good to be able to review it. So again, feel free to review these teachings, and it's great that you have them out there so quickly. Thanks, Donna, for doing that. All right. Thank you all so much, and I'll look forward to seeing you all again in a week. Be well now. Bye-bye.
Bye, Don.
Okay. Bye-bye. You're very welcome. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Don.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Don.
Thank you so much.
Just to let everyone know that the chart that Don showed us tonight is up on the website on the same page where the other texts are, so you can find that tonight, too.